the field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon once again, everybody. Welcome, indeed, to the final furlong show, this Trainer Talk edition, all presented by Frankel's three-quarter brother, Bullet Train, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. We welcome everybody just joining us across the country and throughout North America on Sirius Channel 93. And for those of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 209, welcome back. Happy to have you back with us here. And a fun show planned. Peter Walder is going to be our special guest here in the first half. That's how we will begin this edition of Trainer Talk. And JT, looking forward to this visit.
Yeah, I'm interested to talk to him. We're Twitter friends, but that's all. So,
he tweets?
He's a fantastic Twitter man, and loves to get his updates about his horses and stuff. So looking forward to this.
Well, Peter, the 46-year-old native of Montreal, he began training in 1994. To date, he has saddled 634 winners with purse earnings of more than $11 million. Of course, he had that magical run with Force Freeze, who finished second in the 2011 Breeders' Cup Sprint. We'll ask him about that. But first things being first, Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Two things I want to touch on. Number one, I'm 44, so thanks for aging me 2 years. and the other thing is, I sure like to know where my share of that $11 million is.
Well, let me just say,
thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome to the program. Like I said, I wasn't
trainers,
a math major, by the way. Obviously,
most trainers blame the loss of their $11 million on one of their former wives. So.
No, I got off easy with that. I've been divorced once, and I gave her a lump sum, and thank God I've made it back since then. And if I never have to see her again, it'll be a day too soon.
So you're big into the social media thing.
I don't do Facebook. I'm just not into that. I just think it's whatever. I'm not going to knock it. I just don't do it. But Twitter, I like Twitter. It's nice and simple. It's to the point, and you really don't, you know, just because somebody follows you, you know, it's not, you don't have to follow them. Whereas I guess with Facebook, if somebody requests you, if you deny them, you feel like a real, you know, you feel kind of bad about it. So this way, you know, I got how many ever followers I have, and I just really, I'm out there more so just for business. I mean, most of the people I follow, it's just business wise, and you know, clients and what have you. But it's kind of cool. You know, after every time I win a race, I like to post a picture of my horse, if I still have them after the race, just chilling in the stall. And my owners appreciate it. And there's some people out there that appreciate it. And, you know, every once in a while, you kind of give a little hint that the horse is doing good, and some gamblers appreciate that. So you got to be careful as a claiming guy. But, you know, every once in a while, I drop a hint that I like one.
Yeah, well, I'm a big Peter Walder fan. I mean, I've been betting on your horses for a long time, and they usually run quite well. So whether you tweet them out or not, I probably still bet on them. But it's a good thing. I think, you know, like Kenny McPeak got a lot of plaudits for taking a picture of that horse's grab quarter. And, you know, I think it's a great educational tool because a lot of people hear that, you know, horse grabbed his quarter and nobody knows what it is. But when Frack Daddy did it and he took a picture, it was, you know, not the prettiest picture in the world, but at least people got an idea of what that injury is like. And then people always love the pictures of the horses or the beautiful sunrises that Mark Hennig loves to post in the mornings. And, you know, just get you in the mood for a little horse racing sometimes.
Oh yeah. No, I think I posted a couple of the sun coming up the Gulfstream and put like, who is the best, you know, who wouldn't want to be here. I mean, it's just, there's some great pictures you could take, and I mean, I don't usually, like, if I'm taking pictures of the horses, I usually just email them to my clients. You know, the odd when I had four threes, I think I tweeted a couple pictures of him at the time. But for the most part, the actual, you know, like I said, after they win, I put them online. But the, you know, if I got them galloping or something, I just directly email my clients. That's a little bit more personal. So I try to, you know, you got to try to separate what you want everybody to see and what you don't, kind of thing.
What's your Twitter handle? Do you want to give it out so people can follow you?
It's what is it? That's a good question.
Is it Peter Walder Racing? Is that what?
Yeah, I think it's at P Walder Racing. That's a damn good question. I'll look it up while you're asking me questions. I guess I really should. I should know it, right? Yeah, it's P Walder Race. It's at P Walder Racing.
All right, there you go, at P. Walder Racing, and you can follow Peter Walder. Trust me, it'll be a lot of fun to be following Peter Walder. Pete, let's go back to the beginning. First of all, you're somewhat multi-talented here, right? Because you went to college on a baseball scholarship, so you're not just a talented trainer, but you're also a pretty talented athlete.
Yeah, I don't know about now. I'm not out of shape, but I don't know how well I could throw a ball now, but yeah, back in the day when I played high school baseball in Los Angeles, and I threw a pretty mean curveball. Got recruited and went to the University of Niagara, and that was fun. You know, it was fun to be a kid in college and party and come down to Florida for spring break and do all the stuff the kids do and not remember. I ended up hurting my shoulder, and it came to a time where I had to decide whether I wanted to continue on with baseball and do the surgery, or whether I wanted to face reality. And that was that I was just ordinary in college. You know, I was, like I said, I was very good in high school, and just when I got to college, just everybody was great, and it was just I just came to realization that. You know, that I wasn't good enough. And it's sad. A lot of people continue on with that dream. But I have this fortune cookie that I keep in my wallet. And I've had it for like 15, 17 years. And it says, don't be divided from the truth by what you would like to believe. And it is so true. It's just, you know, I knew at that point that if I was just average in college, there was no way I was going to make it to the pro. So seeing how I always hated school, like most kids, I dropped out, and I drove my car to Toronto, where my grandparents were. I had a business, and my grandfather owned horses, and I grabbed a job with the guy that was training his horses, and started at the ground and worked my way up.
How'd you get hooked on horse racing?
Well, like I said, my grandfather used to own horses, and when I was a kid, he took me to Blue Bonnet's racetrack in Montreal. I spent my first 9 years of my career in Montreal, my life. So I spent my first 9 years in Montreal, and he used to bribe me. He used to offer me $20 to go with him to Blue Bonnet's, and I used to bet on the harness. Back then, we used to call them the cheaters, and some people still do that now, but the harness horses. And then, you know, every once in a while, I used to make a deal with him that if I went with him for a week straight, that he would have to go to Saratoga for a day. So we went to Saratoga. I remember seeing Lady Secret and Track Baron and, you know, some of those great horses. I just, you know, because he owned horses at Woodbine, we used to take a drive up there once a month or something. And it's just something I fell in love with. And deep in my heart, it's something I knew that I always wanted to do, you know. And once baseball... once I got hurt in baseball, I knew it was a no-brainer. That you know, I dabbled in some journalism, and you know, I took psychology in college, but you know, I can't figure myself out, let alone sit there trying to figure other people out. So
well, you
it came pretty easy. I mean, listen, you know, I went in there and I worked for Brian Kessel, who, like I said, had some of my grandfather horses. The guy I learned the most out of in Woodbine when I was there was a guy named Alex Bancuti. He was a hard-nosed Hungarian guy, and he was very tough and just really taught me a lot about the legs, you know, because he had some claiming horses. I worked for Roger Atfield for a year, and I loved Roger. We had a great crew there with him and Mike Keogh and his ex-wife Tracy. She's a sweetheart. But you really don't learn anything over there, because anytime a horse got hurt, they just went to the farm. Whereas when I was with Alex, you know, these claiming horses, if one has an issue, you got to deal with it. You can't just send them away. So I learned a lot that way, you know, on how to patch up a horse and go.
Well, you've done an absolutely tremendous job with your claims. I don't know what your percentage is this week, but it's usually around 30 or 32 right off the bat. And obviously, you learned some lessons well from the Mad Hungarian.
Yeah, no, he, like I said, I, a lot of it, I, you know, I work for a few people between Brian Kessel and Cox up there, I work for. And, you know, like I said, Roger Atfield and a few other people. You kind of put things together yourself. And, you know, I'm a little bit unorthodox when it comes to claiming the horses. Most people claim a horse and they run them back in 2 weeks. And I don't believe in that. I think if you run them back in any quicker than a month, I think you're running them back off somebody else's training. So although some of my owners are impatient and do like to run back quicker, I just stick to what I do and it seems to work. And the horses seem to respond to it. So.
Talk about that process a little bit and how you might pick out a horse to claim and what you look for and then what you do after you get them.
Well, you know, one of my old clients, one of my first clients, a guy named Miller, I pretty much followed his philosophy. He always looked for a horse that ran for more than you're claiming it for, which I like, because that usually means if they have some backlash, if you get them right, you can get them back to that. So I always agree with that. You always look for a horse that had the starts, because if they have starts, it means they're somewhat sound. And I agree with that. And then, you know, kind of look off somebody who in the back of your mind, you know, might not be, you know, given the best of care, or might not be able to do the vet work that they need, or might have a blacksmith that's not as good as yours, or their vet might not be as good. So, you know, knowing the players, it's kind of like poker. You know, when you're sitting there claiming, it's just like poker. You're trying to figure out why this person is doing that or that. But, I mean, as a rule of thumb, like I said, I like to see the starts. I like to see a horse that's run for more. And you generally like to claim off of people who hit at a less percentage than I do. You know, I have claimed a few off Jamie Ness at this meet. We've been picking off each other. And I've gotten kind of lucky. You know, I had this Philly Stoney's Angel win by a pole the other day, in an allowance race that I claimed off him. So, but you know, I try to generally take off people with lesser percentages, because the guys that win like I do, like he does, like Dutro did, and Catalano, I have respect for them, and I just don't think there's much meat on the bone there. So I like to pick off people that I think I can improve off and not just hold steady at.
You talk about the starts, and people are always shocked. When I was in high school, which is a long, long time ago, my uncle, he wouldn't claim a horse unless he'd run 24 times the year before. And
yeah,
now,
I mean, now I see that's a mantra. I look at some of these trainers over at Calder, and I see them run 17, 18, 19, 20 times, and I just want to shoot them. I mean, that's just crazy. I mean, not the horses, the people. I think it's inhumane to run a horse that many times. And I think that if they were to wake up and realize that it's not the quantity of the starts, it's the quality, and just back off the animal, I think they'd get a lot better results. But for whatever reason, some of the trainers over there, they just can't figure that out. And those are the guys I like to pick on.
Yeah, Peter, what's the formula that you have? I mean, you've had so much success with the claiming horses, but the formula, if you can even call it that, of selecting where they're going to go next after you claim them?
I think that's just a lot of them telling me how they're doing. You know, you claim a horse and you know, you train on them. I generally like to work. In my perfect world, I'm able to work a horse twice. I like to give them 3 weeks of training and then work them an easy half and then come back and work them a good half. And you kind of I have three spots picked out. I have, okay, the same spot that we claimed them for. They're just okay. Run them higher. I really like them. And very rarely will I run a horse back for lower than I claimed them for, because I don't think it's fair to the client. And you know, sometimes, you know, horses lie to you. They work okay, and you think, man, I'm really not happy with this one. And then all of a sudden they go out there and they win. I had the other horse that I went with on Sunday, she just worked okay. She worked like in 50, and I really wasn't that impressed. And I wish I had one more work in her, and we ran her, and she wins. So I generally, unless I claim an absolute train wreck, you won't see me claim one and run it for lower than I claim it for. You know, either they're a train wreck or if races just don't go and I don't have a choice. You know, and sometimes you get aggressive owners that don't want to wait. You know, if you claim one for 25 and the 25 was back, you know, and it didn't go, the guy would rather, like when I was training for Dub, he always liked to go lower than higher. So, you know, that comes into play too, where your client, how aggressive your clients want to be as well.
Yeah, some clients, they make you win because they want to run cheap, but most of them are the other way. They never want to drop
and
one.
And it goes both ways.
Yeah.
And, I mean, believe me, there's some of my clients I argue with. You know, they tell me to run cheaper, and I have to beg with them to run. Hey, we don't want to give this one away. And, you know, you gotta communicate. You have to communicate.
Peter Walder, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Peter, you've been on both ends of the spectrum. You've been at the top of the game with a horse like Force Freeze finishing second in the Breeders' Cup Sprint, and now you've had a lot of success on the claiming end of things too. Two completely different games. Talk about the biggest difference between playing at each of those various levels.
Well, man, that was a hell of a run. I mean, and that was incredible. The Breeders' Cup was incredible. I really, 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 really thought I was going to win the Breeders' Cup. You know, when Paco, when we win on Haskell Day, the Teddy Drone. I mean, I had chills. I mean, the track wasn't that fast that day. He went 7-3, and he pulled away from Jerseytown. And Barkley called me afterwards, and I had Todd text me, and I knew I had a special horse, and I called the owner. First time I had talked to an owner, he was on a plane, and I thanked him for the horse, and I said, make your reservations for Churchill because we're going to the Breeders' Cup. And when the stable manager called me up, he says, you're shooting kind of high, aren't you? I said, let me tell you something. I said, horses don't do that. They don't go that fast early and run away and high from grade one winners like that. They just don't. And then he ran an awesome race in the Vosburgh, a race that he probably should have won. Paco hit him a couple times left-handed. He was drifting a little bit and got beat in the neck. And then, you know, we had the Breeders' Cup, and it was awesome. I mean, it was. You know, my girlfriend won it a couple of years ago with El Doffer, and that was a good experience because I played a big hand in you know, putting that all together as far as getting IEAH involved and putting the money up for the entry fee and getting Johnny on the horse. So I had a taste of it then, but to have your own horse in there, and you know, in my heart, I really believe I ran the best horse. I can truly tell you that Johnny didn't get along with that horse. Johnny came to Monmouth and he worked him for me one time and he kind of ran off with him in the work. And even in the race, when he tried, you know, those two horses were quarter horse and down early, they went 21 and change. And I guess Johnny reached to try and get a little bit of a hold of him. That's what he told me anyway. And I think the horses grabbed a hold and took off. And if I had to do it all over again, I would have left Paco on, and I kicked myself in the ass for doing it all the time. But I really believe that if Paco would have rode that horse that day, he might have sat a little bit longer and we would have waited to take the lead and I probably would have won the race. But, you know, listen, you win every race. Every time you think about stuff, you always win races when you play them over in your mind. But, you know, that's why I took Johnny off. I mean, Johnny rode a lot of horses for me, had a lot of success, but I took him off because I really just didn't feel that he suited that horse. I thought Paco suited him like a glove, and he came back and he won a Gulfstream Park Sprint. And you know, he showed that I was right. But you know, it was a great run with him. It was awesome being at that level. Is incredible. You know, it just you know, you keep on waiting for something different to happen, but everything's the same. You put the bridle on the same. You put the bandage on the same. You walk over the same. It's just you're in the spotlight and you're running for a lot more money. But you do everything. The preparation is exactly the same. You know, we had a great year between him and we win the stake up in Maryland with Lacey Slew. I had Sweet and Sour Nina, who ran third to Harv de Grace. So, and we had an awesome year last year. I had three great horses in my barn, and now this year it's back to the meat and potatoes of the business. So, you know, it's I kind of hope that the wheel was turning and maybe people would see that I'm not just a claiming trainer. But you know, unfortunately, I don't have people that shuttle me horses like him. And I just got to get lucky and have them fall into my lap. And hopefully I don't have to wait another 15 years for that to happen. But, you know, the bottom line is if you could train a horse, you could train a horse. And I could train a horse. And hopefully, like I said, I'll have another opportunity to get back to the Breeders' Cup with, whether it be something I claim or something that somebody's I'm fortunate to get from a client. You know, it was great. It was great to be there. And and I really appreciate the opportunity I had, and hopefully it could happen again.
Sometimes you have to make a conscious decision to do that. I know when Bobby Frankel switched over from claiming horses to better horses, he just said, "This is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to claim horses anymore. I'm going to really concentrate on getting better horses." And it worked for him. I know that doesn't work for everybody. It goes back to your fortune cookie message, you know. But
and I'll tell you what I've seen. Not to interrupt you, but I've seen. I won't mention his name, but I saw a trainer from Maryland try to make that transition. He was a claiming guy, and he tried to make that transition. He stopped claiming horses. He went to the sale and he bought horses, and his clients were buying horses between $60,000 and $150,000. And he was coming down here to Gulfstream. And when you're buying those type of horses and you're running against Pletcher, who's buying them for $500,000 and $1 million, I mean, you're really up against it. I mean, back when Frankel decided to do that, there was a better chance of doing it when he did it. Now, when you're going up against Todd and you know, Bill Mott, as strong as he is, and Chad Brown, as strong, I mean, you're really, really, really up against it if you try to make that transition.
Yeah,
it's just really tough.
I agree with you, because even now with the Dubai Carnival, in the old days you used to be able to buy European horses relatively reasonably, which is one of the routes that Frankel took. And now the European horses are very expensive because they have a place to run in the wintertime.
Yeah, no, it's very tough. I mean, like I said, those guys, listen, I respect Todd. I think he does a great job. He gets some of the best horses we have in this country, but I mean, you know, listen, good luck on trying to go. Like I said, you go to sale, you buy a horse for 100 or 200, you're in the gate with them or Besselou or you know, Chad Brown or the Westes. And, I mean, good luck. I mean, you know, and then next thing you know, your clients get frustrated because they spent what they think is a lot of money, and they're finishing third or fourth to these monsters that these guys are paying millions for. So I'm going to stick to what I do. Which is what I think I do well, and I feel very fortunate for the success that I've had, and I'll stick to what I do, and like I said, whether I claim a horse like Forest Freeze, or whether I'm fortunate enough that maybe somebody's not doing as good with the stake horse as they once were, and somebody wants to think they need to change the scenery, or somehow one just ends up in my barn. I mean, hopefully it'll happen again, and I'm sure I'll do a great job with it.
Talking with trainer Peter Walder here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Peter, just a couple of minutes left here to wrap things up. Believe it or not, this 30 minutes is almost over. It's flown by. Outside of Force Freeze, a couple of other horses that will really stand out to you in terms of horses that help put you on the map and launch your career.
Well, I had a horse called Pyramus, and she was the first one that I actually went a stake race with. I claimed her off of Maggie Moss, who I ended up training for. I love Maggie. She's great. She's great for the business. Still remain friends with her. We claimed Pyramus. I think we win 16 races with her over a four-year span. She won a $100,000 race in Delaware, like I said, my first stake. I actually lost her through the claim box and bought her back privately just so I could send her home to the original breeder. So she was special in my heart. Another one who I just lost the other day, a horse called Livingston Street. We claimed him for $25,000 last year. Went about six races with him. He made $150,000. You know, Lacey Slew, who I had mentioned, Sweet and Sour Nina. I loved her to death. She was a sweetheart to have in the barn. You know, there's been so many horses coming in and out of my barn that have just been, you know, special. You know, I wish he could have stuck around. Had an old horse called Make the Right Move. I bought from Sonny Hine right before he passed away. Won a bunch of races with him. Had a horse called Sure Star. I win like eight in a row with. Just going way back to my Woodbine days. Just so many of them. So many. So many.
Who's the horse that's on the background of your Twitter page there? Is that a horse, any horse
in particular? That's the horse I'm giving a kiss to.
No, I didn't see that one.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure I'm giving a horse a kiss, and that's Force Freeze walking into the winner's circle.
Oh, I see it. Yeah, okay. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, I just followed you on Twitter, by the way.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll be sure to follow you back. Yeah, but that's, yeah, when he walked into the winner's circle, I gave him a kiss. And I generally do that with all my horses.
Yeah, I used to do that too.
He got an extra long one. he got some real love behind that one.
Yeah, that's good. That's That's absolutely fantastic. I mean, you know, when you're around those horses all the time and you have such respect for them, you know, a lot of them, when you get them, is when you claim them, they've got their issues and stuff. And it really does make you feel good to get them feeling good and being happy on the racetrack.
Yeah, no, you know, and tell you the truth, like, there are some people who, listen, it's a business, and I understand that. But I subscribe to the theory that a happy horse will run. And more than anything, I try to get my horses happy. And my horses, I mean, I'm sitting in my office right now, and I'm staring at a big thing of mints that I have here. And they just get spoiled, like Livingston Street. My one hot walker I used to have used to feed them Famous Amos cookies. I mean, we just spoil them to death. And they respond. I mean, they're happy. And not only, but I appreciate them. I really do. I appreciate my horses, and you know, they go out there and in turn, I think they appreciate me and they show up by the way they run.
Well, Peter, we certainly appreciate you taking the time to join us here tonight on Trainer Talk. Been a lot of fun to visit with you, hear your story, and we could have spent another half an hour with you for sure. But thank you so much for being here, and we'll catch up with you soon. All the best.
Guys, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I like that anybody wants to follow me, if you all the racing at Twitter, I appreciate that. And anytime you want me on, I'd be more than happy to come back.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
All right, Peter Walder.
That was fun.
Yeah. High energy individual.
Yeah. Well,
he's great.
You can tell once you follow him on Twitter, you'll see.
He loves the game.
Yeah, and he loves Miami too, so how could that be bad?
Yeah, we didn't even get into that, did we?
No. Maybe better we didn't.
From Montreal to Miami.
There you go.
All right, Peter Walder, our special guest. Second half of Trainer Talk presented by Bullet Train coming up next, right after this break. Stay tuned. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, our producer Lee Delapina, are all with you here in studio. Second half up next here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train, it's time to get on board.
Group-winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at two with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a group one. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjou and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
Have you always dreamed of being at Churchill Downs on the first Saturday in May? Have clients, partners, or employees who deserve to be rewarded with the trip of a lifetime? Then visit DerbyBox.com. DerbyBox.com has been fulfilling Derby dreams for more than 25 years. Your Kentucky Derby package is just a click away, so don't delay. Visit DerbyBox.com and you'll be on your way to experience the two greatest minutes in sports. DerbyBox.com is not affiliated with Churchill Downs or any of its associated companies.
RaceHorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RaceHorseReport.com. Make RaceHorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RaceHorseReport.com.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Illman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets. And now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love. And DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, plus free wagering guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, one-click multi-ticket wagering with DRF Ticketmaker, trusted Daily Racing Form customer support, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
Hi, this is Joel Rosario.
Hi, this is Jockey John Cork.
Hi, this is Calvin Burrow. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Franco's three-quarter brother, Bullet Train, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Mike Penna, Jude Feld with you here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And JT, a really fun visit in the first half of the show with trainer Peter Walder. He's always great to catch up with, always a high-energy type of individual. Had some great lines in that half-an-hour interview.
Yeah, he's the original Miami man. He loves it down there and really enjoys his time at Gulfstream Park. And I bet you he's just delighted that they're going to be racing year-round at Gulfstream.
And we, of course, are delighted to bring you our guest here in the second half of the show. That's trainer Kate DeMasi, and not quite the household name of a Bob Baffert or a Todd Pletcher, but she has done a remarkable job. She recently just reached a tremendous milestone with her 1,000th career winner. She is one of only a handful of women trainers to ever do so, and according to Equibase, the youngest ever to achieve that mark, and she is nice enough to join us now. Kate, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you guys today. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, happy to have you on board, and congratulations on that milestone. Just an amazing accomplishment.
Well, thanks, and I did not realize that I was one of the youngest to ever do that.
Hey, that's the word on the street. That's a good thing, right?
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, well, congratulations. You and I caught up yesterday, and you told me that you're still not exactly sure where that 1,000th victory occurred.
That's correct, because I guess by the numbers that they had on Equibase, I guess there was, you know, a little confusion on my name. And then, of course, I did have some victories under my maiden name, too. So that actually, I think, puts me somewhere around closer to 1030. According to their numbers. So it probably was sometime last summer, I would think.
Yeah, that's always a problem with gals when they train. They sometimes get married and change their name, and it creates havoc with the record books. You wouldn't think it would be that hard. But my father had a woman trainer in the 50s. She was the only woman to have stalls at Santa Anita. Her name was Mary G. Ellis, and she raced mainly on the fairs, but her horses were good enough to go to Santa Anita. And I always tell everybody, when I got married in 1981, my wife had to have a trainer's wife badge. That was 1981.
Wow.
So for you to do what you've done in a short period of time, you've come a long way, baby.
Well, yes, and women in general in the sport, I think, have. And, you know, you got to remember, I grew up during the era of Billie Jean King. So that tells you something about women in the sport. How there was just there's really, women have come a long, long way in this game.
Was there a certain trainer when you were growing up, Kate, that you looked up to, and maybe a role model type of individual?
Well, you know, I worked for Richard Dutrow Sr., and he was absolutely a class act. He was the most kind person to work for. He, you know, you learned a lot from him. He just was a wonderful person to learn from. And, you know, I never really had to work for any women trainers. There really wasn't that many around. There were certainly women trainers then, but I worked for Mr. Dutrow Sr. And like I said, everybody called him Dad because he was like that to everyone. He was quite a role model.
Well, let's go back to the beginning and talk about how you got into racing, how you got hooked on the sport. You mentioned, you know, growing up at the time of Billie Jean King. How'd you make this decision to get into training and fall in love with horse racing?
Well, I grew up around horses because I did grow up on a farm on the eastern shore of Maryland. And so we grew, you know, corn and soybeans and hay and things like that. We did have some horses. My parents had always wanted to have some horses, so they had a few thoroughbreds. So I had a little bit of an introduction that way, even though it was just kind of a dabbling. But my mom started a local pony club during that time. They were just getting started in the United States, and I was probably about six. So I got a real education from an early age, you know, just through pony club. They taught you a lot. And so that was sort of a little jump start into getting introduced to the racing world, because growing up, my parents did have a few, you know, cheap horses. They used to run at Charlestown and Timonium. And so I kind of got the experience that way of just being on the fringe of it. And then, of course, when I was old enough to kind of be bit with the racetrack bug, well, you know, the rest is kind of history from there. You know, you go to the work at the racetrack and you kind of become an apprentice, so to speak, you know, working and watching and learning and listening, you know, doing all that sort of thing. So.
How old were you when you got bit by that racetrack bug?
I think I was probably 16.
Yeah, was there a moment?
I used to work the summers. We were about an hour away from Bowie at the time and Laurel. So during the summertime, I would work at the racetracks there, and then they went to Delaware Park back in those days. That was long, long, long before slots at Delaware Park, obviously. That would have probably been like the early 80s.
When you were working on the track in those early years, were you rubbing horses, galloping horses? How did you get started?
I was rubbing horses back then. I did have experience riding, but I never thought of myself as a very good gallop rider. So even when I did strike out on my own and I did everything, you know, rub, ride, muck in, everything, I recognized early on that that was not my forte. So I was much better on the ground, but I am quite capable of galloping, but I would never want to do it as a livelihood. That's for sure.
Who gave you your first job on the track?
It would have been Mr. Dutcher Sr.
That was your first one. Okay.
Yeah. And I stayed there a long time. You know, in general, I stayed there until I was ready to take my trainer's test, and then I struck out on my own. And I actually, at the time, I knew I was going to just have some homegrown tomatoes, basically. They were not much. And so I went to Delaware Park at that time, and that was, like I said, long before slots, and the purse structure there was really terrible. And, you know, and I got my feet wet there. And the first horse I ever ran, I had actually taken up the Penn National to run, and he won first time out. First horse I ever ran, believe
wow.
it or not.
Very nicely
won,
done.
So.
Easy game. It's an easy game, right?
Oh, yeah, easy game. best game played outdoors.
That's right. Well, when you were starting out, how hard was it to get horses? Was it difficult for you as a woman to hustle clients? And, you know, I mean, it just seems like at that time, you know, men were the kingpins. Did you have to work extra hard, or did you how did you get your customers?
Well, actually, it's funny you ask. The first horse I trained, I got really fortunate, and a guy was that actually had come through Mr. Dutrow Sr. He had a cheap little horse, and he gave the horse to me. And, you know, I'm sure he knew the horse was cheap, figured he'd give me a shot. That was a great opportunity. And from there, he actually helped me get another client. So I actually got two clients in the first year or so, you know, just one horse client, so to speak. And they were, you know, they were really just very average or below average bred horses. And, you know, I got lucky and I won a race here and there. And I think things really started to take off later. Once we formed Pewter Stable later, when my husband and I got married, we struck out and kind of started this partnership idea and started Pewter Stable. So we actually were able to bring new clients into the game. And they could, you know, have small ownership in it. And from there, it kind of snowballed, because you get the person that really likes it, and maybe they get a horse on their own. So it's been a real team effort. But getting those first few horses was very hard, very hard. And I got really lucky that, like I said, that somebody was you know, willing to give me the first horse and kind of drum up a little bit of business for me. And, you know, so, and back in those days, like you said, there was not that many, you know, women trainers that had that many horses at the time. So I, like I said, I had a couple of my own that were just, they weren't much. They weren't much.
Well, Pewter Stable has, you know, developed into a premier partnership group. You don't operate at the national level, but certainly the places you race, everybody has seen Pewter Stable's name in the form and, you know, knows about Pewter Stable and you training the horses. Talk about the development of Pewter Stable and how it's transformed from just a small outfit to a much bigger one.
Well, it started, like I say, a long time ago. It was probably in the late 80s. My husband Greg had a horse named Pewter Collection, and that was the first horse. And so when we started the partnership idea and wanted to name the stable, we decided we'd call it Pewter Stable. And from there, like I said, it was just started out with a few friends, or it started out with a few family members. And then he really took the ball and kind of went with it, with kind of getting more people involved. And back then, I think the only partnership that really had any, anybody really knew about was Todd Campbell had the Dogwood partnership. And at that point, there was really nothing that you really heard about, that somebody, if they wanted to just have a little piece of an average horse. And, you know, we live in this area, so the idea of traveling from track to track was not something that was going to fit into what we do. Now, we did do a circuit back then. We had Garden State would run. That was when they rebuilt the new Garden State. That was during that era. And then they would go to Atlantic City, and then we'd return back to Philadelphia Park in the fall. And then eventually, once Atlantic City and Garden State went by the wayside, Parks became my full-time year-round racetrack that we're based at. So from there, you could really, you know, you could run the horses at Delaware or New York or Penn National or in Maryland if you didn't have a race that fit your horse. But Parks is my base. And, of course, we also at that point started breeding our horses in Pennsylvania. We at one time did keep some of our mares, and we would breed some mares and end up with New Jersey breds. But when we saw the handwriting on the wall that Pennsylvania was the place to be year-round, we started foaling everything in Pennsylvania. So we still to this day keep quite a few mares and have a lot of PA breds.
Trainer Kate DeMasi, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kate, when you look back on those 1,000-plus victories throughout your career, who are some of the horses that are going to stand out to you that you're never going to forget?
Well, you know, it's funny you ask that, because there's so many that just, you know, that you do remember certain personalities that were just, you know, they made your day. And one of the horses that we had was a horse named Pewter's Bill. He made us a lot of money. We didn't pay a lot for him. He was a horse I believe we bought as a yearling. And he was a Pennsylvania bred. And some of the other ones that we bought kind of cheap, like TJ's Tough as Nails. That was one that Greg had picked out at the sales. I think that was the Ocala sales back then that we got her from. And she not only won stakes, but placed in a bunch of stakes. She ran against a nice filly at the time, Avi's Fancy, who went on to be quite a broodmare. Those are two real kind of special early on horses. And then in more recent years, I've had a couple nice little stakes horses that, you know, they really made your day, like Mary Princess. You know, that was some real good coverage. One year she won the very one stakes at Pimlico, which was pretty cool. That was always the day before at Preakness, so there was always a lot of press. And, you know, I got to see her on ESPN and, you know, so things like that. But, you know, even the claiming horses, they've been real special. Some of the ones that just ran so hard for you every time you took them over there, you know, they're very special.
Yeah, I was going to ask you your favorite race that you've won. Excuse me, the most memorable race that jumps out to you that you've won throughout your career.
I think I'd have to say it was the very one stakes We had actually taken that mare to Kentucky to run, and it had rained so much, and I was just really paranoid coming off of the layoff. She had physical issues. I was going to run her after this torrential downpour at Churchill Downs, and I scratched her, went all the way out there, scratched her last minute, brought her back, and 2 weeks later, she won the Very One Stakes, and it was so validating that I made the right decision, you know, because at the time, I just was, you know, like I said, the turf was great out there at Churchill, but I just could not bring myself to run her after all the rain they had, and it was her first race off of a layoff, and we had done chip surgery on her, and I said, no, I think we need to wait, and we did, and everybody understood, and she won 2 weeks later at Pimlico. That was probably, I'll never forget that.
Yeah, there's so many times that trainers have to agonize the weather, you know, or maybe something else happens before a race, and you have to decide, are you going to run, are you not going to run? And when it all works out in your favor, which happens not that often, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel smart, and it really gives your entire stable a boost.
Yeah, it really did. And I can remember my dad was standing right next to me there, and she was blocked the entire time down the stretch, and Dominguez was on her. And my father's going, she's not going to get through. And I'm just like holding my breath, and all of a sudden there was enough room, and she shot through like a rocket. It was just like, oh, my God. It was like scripted out of a movie. So that was pretty cool.
Well, as you said, probably the greatest game played outdoors. It's a tremendous sport. And you've had, excuse me, obviously a very strong impact, Kate, with everything that you've been able to accomplish. We started off talking about you being a woman in a largely male-dominated sport. Have those challenges for you become easier over the years?
I think they've become easier. And I think that, you know, overall, it's much more accepted, women in the sport. But I still think there is a little bit more of a battle to get clients, to have them really have the confidence in you. I think people tend to think women train, you know, they don't train hard enough, therefore they're not going to have really good horses. So I do think there's a little stigma that way. You know, you just have to keep plugging away at it. I mean, even some of the girl riders you see come around, you know, the Julie Crones of yesteryear, you know, they just don't come along every day. And again, there's somebody else who, you know, was dominating at that time, you know, the women, and she was just a dominant woman in that era. So it really is hard, but I don't think if you just keep plugging away at it, you will get your opportunity. You will get your opportunity. But I do think there's, you know, It's still a little bit of an uphill battle, I think.
Were you ever involved in a situation where an owner said, you know, I'm not giving my horse to a gal, just not going to do it? Has that ever happened to you?
No, I can't say that it has. I really can't. But I have had people that, you know, kind of interviewed you, talked about giving you horses, and they said they were talking to some other trainers, and then later they end up giving it to, you were like, maybe one of four people, and they give it to some other guy trainer that you're going, what?
That yeah.
You know, it's like, okay.
Yeah, good luck to you.
but like I said, I mean, we really have some wonderful people that I've trained for and still train for. And it's just, you know, they've been so supportive, and I really have to thank everybody who's helped make that 1,000 wins, you know, because this is tough as an owner. I mean, it's tough to get owners, it's tough to keep owners, and, you know, especially in a sport that, you know, it's really about having fun in this game, because really as clients don't make a lot of money. You're lucky if you break even, really. I mean, it's really about having fun, enjoying your horse racing, and I don't think anybody gets in it and says, I'm going to make $1 million in this game.
Well, Yeah, no, it's true.
It's about enjoying it.
It's a tough game to make money in, but it's a game that's great when you're in it, and if you can have a little bit of success, it certainly goes a long way. You talked about Rick Dutrow Sr., and you just mentioned other people kind of in general that have helped you along the way in terms of accomplishing everything that you've been able to do in this game. Who are some of the other people, Kate, that have helped you outside of Mr. Dutrow?
Well, you know, we trained for Mike Rapoli when he was early on in the game, and I think he learned a lot from us, and I learned a lot from him. It was a good relationship, and you know, I every time I see another good horse that he has, I think that's great, and I'm so happy. I'm so happy that I was a part of that and that I had the opportunity to know him. And he and Greg really had a lot of wonderful conversations about horses that were, you know, that we were going to be looking at and stuff like that. So that was a real big boost on, you know, just because of the claiming game at the time. That was what he was doing primarily. And, you know, that really helped probably a lot of my numbers overall because, as I said, we do breed a lot of horses, and we go to the sales. And when you have young horses, you know as well as anybody, it's hard to have the numbers because they just don't start as much, and you have to kind of figure out where their niche is going to be. Are they going to be routers, sprinters? Do they need to run for 40,000 or 10,000? And it's a numbers game that way. And having someone that did a lot of claiming, That was big in getting a lot of numbers. And like I said, all the members that we've had, you know, part of Pewter have really been wonderful.
Well, Mike Rapoli is the kind of guy that'll make you win because he's not afraid to drop one down either. Those guys, they're really the trainer's best friend. If you can run a horse, you know, maybe a little out of line and catch two or three wins while everybody's napping, it's a pretty good situation.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, Mike was a quick learner. Didn't take him long to figure out the game anyway. So, you know, he learned it very, very quickly, and he asked a lot of questions. And so, like I said, it was a real good relationship, I think, for both of us. And like I said, you know, just picking out horses to claim and things like that, you know, he and Greg would talk about what horses made sense and where are we going to go with this one? What are we going to do with this one? You know, he's what conditions does he have left? You know, is he going to fit? You know, so it was all a real great opportunity for all of us.
And of course, working with your husband, Greg, how's that work out for you?
It works good because I get to handle the horses and I'm the hands-on person and I'm making all those day-to-day decisions, but he is wonderful at reading the catalogs and the past performances. He's a really good handicapper. So we're two different segments of the game, so to speak. So it works out really well. I mean, so we don't work in the barn together because I'm the hands-on person, but I tell you, you cannot be in this game without somebody good that's looking out for where's the next horse coming from. And my hat's off to somebody who can do it all because it's not something you can do by yourself. And you've got to have somebody who's paying attention to the sale, paying attention to what's fashionable breeding, you know, what's selling, all of those factors, along with, you know, is this horse going to fit in our operation? If we claim this horse, is he going to be able to have another race to run in, or is he not going to fit here? Or, you know, what's the upside of them? What's the downside of them? And that's a helpful person to have, and that's what that Greg's really good at. And like I said, I'm the other end handling the horses and knowing, you know, this one's getting an ankle. He needs to go away. You know, that kind of thing. So he needs time. You know, let's send him to the farm or whatever. So I'm the, you know, that's my forte.
That's the same type of system that Doug O'Neill uses with his brother Dennis. Dennis is at the sales. He's reading the sheets for handicapping purposes and all of that. So makes for a good partnership and obviously a good recipe for success.
Yeah, like I said, it's really hard to be a master of all trades. It really is. So you really have to have people that are in your corner and looking out for where the next, like I say, the next horse is going to come from.
Well, Kate, we always like to kind of finish up our Trainer Talk interviews by asking our trainers a little bit more about themselves outside of racing. What are some of the things that, you like to do when you're not in those few minutes when you're not actually at the barn?
Well, one of the pastimes I took up a few years ago, because I do like horses, but I never really get to ride, is, I like to go just trail riding and enjoying my little mare. I have a little horse that I've re-schooled, that was off the track, and I've done a little fox hunting with her, and I've met a great little group of people that like to fox hunt. And so when I get the opportunity to get a day where I can go, I like to do that. And I really enjoy just all kinds of museums and things like that in the theater. So, whenever I can meet a couple of my girlfriends, like in New York or something, I just love going up there. I enjoyed War Horse immensely on the stage. So I like doing things like that. So it's a nice little break away from the racetrack, but we don't get too far away from the horses.
Yeah, a little culture to go along with the day-to-day grind of being a horse trainer. That's cool.
Yeah. And it's always good to just, see my family still all lives on the Eastern Shore. So just getting down there and you sort of just fall back in that sort of country way again, it's really enjoyable because, not a lot has changed, even though it's starting to get a lot more developed. It's a nice part of Maryland where, it's still farmland.
Are any of your other immediate family members involved in the sport, Kate?
I think I mentioned to you, my dad actually held a trainer's license, and actually before the show, I just went on Equibase, and evidently he is actually on there now, and I didn't see him there before, so I got a kick out of that. But he didn't do it as a living, but he's very much involved in, what's going on with me. He likes to watch the horses and, watches them on the computer and stuff like that when he can't get over to, to Harrington or something to watch them. But, like I said, we had horses growing up, so he's very much involved in that. But he's the only other family member that's really involved in horses. The rest of them, like I said, my brother, he's a farmer, and he's still on the farm where I grew up. So, like I said, it's always nice to go back and visit.
Well, Kate, congratulations again on that 1,000 victory milestone. Just an incredible accomplishment, and best of luck here in the future. We want to thank you for taking the time here tonight to be with us on Trainer Talk, and look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Well, thanks so much, and again, thanks for having me, and thanks to everybody who helped along the way to make that 1,000 wins. It's an incredible feeling.
Well said. Kate DeMasi, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, and that'll just about wrap up a very fun show. We had Peter Walder in the first half of the show, then Kate DeMasi here in the second half. And always fun to visit with somebody like that, Jude, who is under the radar, maybe it would be a good term to describe Kate's career. She's not Bob Baffert. She's not Todd Pletcher. She's not Steve Asmussen, but an integral part of what makes this sport go.
Well, she runs horses at many different tracks, and you see that pewter stable in the form all the time, and the horses usually run good. I always keep an eye out for him when I'm handicapping.
Yeah, tremendous accomplishment there with 1,000 career victories. We certainly thank her and Peter for being with us on the show here tonight. Don't forget, we are back tomorrow, 3 to 7 Eastern Time, with our HRN Live coverage from 3 to 6, and then 6 to 7, this final Furlong show will be our BristNet.com call-in show presented by Twin Spires. We return on Friday as well. We're going to be here with you to bring you live racing coverage from around the country, but also the Grade 1 Makers 46 Mile at Keeneland, and that's a great race because of the fact it's going to include Horse of the Year Wise Dan, so can't wait to see him get started again on Friday.
Well, it's going to be like Wise Dan and everybody else.
Probably will.
I said it was going to be a walkover, and some guy on Twitter kind of got in my face about it. But
really?
Yeah, he said he wanted me to prove that to him. Well, we'll just wait till Friday.
That's right.
We'll let Wise Dan do the talking.
Well, join us for that coverage from 3 to 6 on Friday afternoon, from 6 to 7. You can stay with us on Friday and get ready for the big races this weekend that we're going to have for you on HRN with our Express Bet Weekend Stakes preview. And then Saturday, of course, our Equine Forum show from 8 to 10 and our coverage of the Bluegrass Stakes and the Arkansas Derby, the final two major stepping stones on that road to Louisville.
Crazy week.
going to be insane. You can visit horseracingradio.net for more information and check it all out with us. Make us your home for all things Derby, as we are your exclusive home for Kentucky Derby 139. Going to be on site with more than 20, well, I guess about 17 hours of coverage Derby week. How about that?
That's a lot.
We're going to be busy.
Yeah, well, as usual. Not complaining, though. We got the best location in the world for the Kentucky Derby.
All right, our thanks to Peter Walder and to Kate DeMasi for joining us here on the show. Trainer Talk presented by Bullet Train. We're back tomorrow on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.